Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
This is Radio Free Potato, episode number one. Hey, all right. Hopefully many more to come. And if you're here for the first episode, well, I wish I had some kind of prize that I could give you. Perhaps some money, maybe $1 million. But honestly, if I had $1 million, I would probably selfishly keep that for myself and buy something really nice. But alas, I can't give away any prizes. Hopefully that listening to the show, you know, just listening will be reward enough. Of course, it's the holiday season. Hope everybody is having a magical Christmas and getting ready for a fun new year as we go into 2012, the last year apparently on the Earth, according to one of the many Mayan calendars that, and you know, I don't know about that. The Mayan calendar ends at 2012. The one on my wall ends at the end of this month. So who knows when it's going to happen. Personally, I've been thinking about my New Year's resolutions. Normally, I wouldn't be too worried about this, but my New Year's resolution last year was to actually make one this year. So I guess I have to. I think it's a rule or something. I'm pretty sure. So, you know, I don't know how many of you out there actually celebrate Christmas anymore. Personally, I spent quite a few years just letting it pass by like a normal day, more or less. I mean, I'd buy a gift for a couple of friends here and there and turn on the 24-hour Christmas Story marathon on TBS. But I didn't do the full-blown celebration like I did when I was a kid. I think a lot of people do that once they've grown up and they've moved out of the house. Christmas turns into the exchange of a few gifts and some Bing Crosby playing, you know, over the speakers in the supermarket, and you're just fine with that. But this Christmas, I'm in a bit of a different situation. I have a steady relationship, and we just celebrated our third anniversary, and we're living in a place with another couple we're very close to, and just for some reason, it felt to all of us like we should actually have a Christmas this year with a tree and the fireplace and the wrapped gifts and the stockings and all of that. So we did. And I noticed something. The disorder in Christmas tree decorations is directly proportional to the number of kids that are in the house. Now, I know that sounds a little crazy, but hear me out on this. When I was a kid, I remember going over to my grandmother's house. Now, this is my grandmother. Hasn't had kids in the house for years. And I remember how orderly the Christmas tree at my grandmother's house was. I mean, it was almost alien, this thing. It was color coordinated and the ornaments were arranged evenly on the tree. And to a kid, this thing just looked boring. Not exciting at all. I wanted to go home and look at my tree, which I thought looked much better. Of course, being in a family with two other siblings younger than I was, our tree was an absolute exercise in living chaos. You know, 12 different colored strings of lights, all different sizes. The ornament balls, you could tell how tall each kid in the family was by where the ornament balls were hung. Because the kids want to hang everything at eye level, so there was a ring of balls across the middle of the tree for me, because that's where I was standing. Another ring a little lower than that where my brother put them. And then this bunch of like a dozen balls hanging from the lowest possible branch on one side of this poor tree because it was just the only thing my sister could reach. You know, actually leaning the tree over from the weight of all these metal balls. And the whole thing was covered, absolutely drenched in those metal foil icicles. I don't even know if they make those things anymore. I don't even know if they're legal. This tree could have probably exploded at any moment. But to us, it was the most absolutely magical, wonderful object that we adored it every year. Of course, this year, when we decided to put up a tree, which none of us had really done since we were kids, we matched the colors and we organized the ornaments and actually had a sense of moderation on what we put on the tree. We had rules, you know, we could only put so much. Nothing that made noise would go on the tree. That was one of our main rules, no noise. And I kind of found myself feeling a little bit like an old codger, seeing how much our tree reminded me of my grandmother's old tree when I was a kid. So, I guess in some way a Christmas tree doesn't just represent Christmas when you think about it, but it also represents the family who is celebrating it, since you can certainly tell a lot about a family just by looking at one. Recently found something online that I know a lot of my computer gaming brethren out there will appreciate, especially the science geeks. When I was a kid, I was the button pusher. You've got several different kinds of kids out there. You know, you've got the ones that play with chemicals, and then you have the ones that play with dolls, and then you have the ones that just spin around in a circle aimlessly for hours and hours making that funny noise, you know, whatever. And then you have the button pusher. I was the button pusher. I was in charge of buttons. I mean, my entire neighborhood, I had the highest score at button pushing. And it didn't matter what buttons they were, especially if it lit up when you pushed it. That was my favorite. If it lit up when you pushed the button, I had to push it. It was a compulsion. There was no way to stop me. It was just going to happen. Video games, you know, especially, were, it was buttons. It was nothing but buttons. One time my grandmother actually gave me an old panel from one of those old electronic Baldwin organs. And she rigged up a battery hookup to it so that the buttons would all light up when you pushed the buttons. They didn't do anything, but they just lit up. And she gave that to me for Christmas. My family didn't see me for months. That was my favorite toy for years and years, because I could take that thing and I could use my imagination and be flying a spaceship or in a submarine or flying an airplane or whatever I wanted. And that to me was amazing. So when computer technology got to the point where flight simulators were possible, I was just all over those. You know I was. I would fly simulated planes around for hours. There's not a device yet created that could calculate the amount of time that I spent flying simulated airplanes around a simulated world. Hey, an airplane flight deck is loaded with buttons. It's button heaven in there. So how could I not love a thing like that, right? You know. Well, now, even though I'm nearly 40 years old, that button pushy thing, you never lose that. It's like riding a bike. It's like anything. You just don't lose it. I'll be 90 years old and in my deathbed, and I'll be pushing the buttons on my life support machine just to see what they do. That's probably how I'll die. The point is, I found something recently. Rather, it was shown to me by a friend that just thrilled that button pusher in me to no end. And it's a program called Orbiter Space Flight Simulator. And let me tell you, this thing is just magical. If you are one of the button pushy kids out there, or you like, you know, flight simulators, this thing is absolutely, it's heaven. It's wonderful. It's a very realistic simulator based on Newtonian physics model. And it's a simulator for space flight. Now, something I can tell you is that this is not an easy simulator to fly. It's not even really a game, I don't think I'd call it. It takes about 2 months of goofing off with it just to learn how to use it. The manuals are huge. There's several of them. There's tutorials and things you have to go through. There are no points. There are no achievements, no bragging rights. All you have is your own accomplishments. And believe me, some of them are not easy. But let me tell you, when you can manage to dock with a space station or actually design a flight path and go to Mars, that's really all the thrill you need with this thing. Because chances are, if you can do it in orbiter, you could probably do it in real life. Not to mention, it's a button pusher's absolute dream. Orbiter is free and open source. There are a lot of add-ons to it that you'll eventually need to get, but you can find everything you need to know, along with the program itself, at orbit.medphys.ucl.ac.uk. I know that's a really long URL, and I'm sorry about that, but it's worth it. So, see you all in space! If you're familiar with some of my other work or radio shows, you'll probably have noticed by now that this show is not what you'd usually expect from me. Either way, you're all welcome to listen, and I do hope you find some enjoyment in the show. I've never done a project like this one, so I'm sure there'll be some bugs I need to bang out with the timing and on the technical end, but hopefully it'll all be a journey for both you and me. I decided it was time to make this show for two reasons, really. First, the last couple of years, I've been doing what I've tentatively titled The Secret Show at certain locations across the country. I can't tell you how or where to go to a secret show because, well, then it wouldn't be very secret, would it? But those people out there who've been to a secret show, you know what it is. Basically, I find myself in a room with a scattering of people, and instead of doing a comedy routine or some kind of panel, we lounge around and I tell stories about my life, make some observations, give the folks who came some advice for their own lives, maybe a word of wisdom or two if I can possibly squeeze such a thing out of my face. But, be that as it may, so far The Secret Show has had pretty big impact on those who went. Also, the last couple of times I posted short stories from my life on my blogs or journals, I've gotten some really good feedback from doing that, and it's encouraged me to do this, basically. The second reason is that I've always wanted to do a radio show that feels homey. Up till now, I've had comedy radio shows, I've had radio shows that make people laugh, I've had radio shows that make people mad. I've never done a radio show that makes people just want to sit down and just turn it on and just relax and listen. I've always loved radio shows that you could listen to and come away with something. Some bit of knowledge or emotion or something that evokes memories. If you noticed at the beginning of the show, there was a retro-sounding bumper there. If you missed it, here it is again. That is the music from the CBS special presentation bumper from 1976 to somewhere in the early 80s. When I was a kid, that bumper would send every child in the world into fits of joy when they heard it, because it almost always was followed by some kind of cartoon special on CBS. So to this day, when I hear it, it feels comfortable and relaxing. It just feels nice to hear it. I find it really amazing the emotions some very simple and short pieces of music can evoke. Here's another one you might recognize. That is, of course, the opening theme from 20th Century Fox Productions. I don't know about you, but to me, that short song has somehow, over the years, managed to pack all of the excitement of going to the movies just in a few seconds. How about this one?
Nick, 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 Nick,
Nickelodeon.
Nick, 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 Nick,
Nickelodeon.
That was an old bumper from Nickelodeon, in case you didn't recognize that. I know all the all my older listeners probably are having no trouble listening or recognizing. Now, I know that if there are any younger listeners in the audience, you might not have heard any of these bits of music before, and you might be thinking it's kind of pathetic for an old man to be searching the internet for these old themes and having special feelings about them. And, well, you may be right. I don't know. But don't think that you're immune to this, okay? Out there, kids, consider this little piece of music. That, of course, is the intro theme from all of the Valve video games. I'm sure most of you younger people knew it, what it was, right from the first note. But keep in mind, my dear younger friends, in just a few short years, Valve may change their theme, or they may not even exist. And any computer you could play these games on will be so old at that time, they won't run anymore. In 10 years, that short theme right there might bring you back to a piece of life that you can't have anymore. So these few notes might be more special to you than you think they are. In fact, I can almost guarantee you that there is a library of short songs in your head right now that are going to be very special to you in a few years down the road, and you won't even know it until it happens. Starting this weekend, I will be in Melbourne, Australia. Midfur has asked me to come down to their annual event and do a few performances, and it's always a pleasure to go down and see my Australian friends and spend some time with them, and Midfur is always a wonderful event to go to. It's very well run, very classy. I always enjoy it down there. After that, I will be attending Further Confusion in San Jose, California, for those of you who are curious. And I will be doing my comedy show there as well, and also selling my latest DVDs for those who want to pick up a copy. One of the things I'll be doing on this show is what I guess they call dramatic readings. For those of you who have enjoyed some of the stories I've told about my own life that I was mentioning before, this is where I will do that. I might not always read something I've written myself. Sometimes I might throw in some poetry or something that has stood out to me that someone else has written, but most of the time, I want to do readings that are from my own memoirs. I don't really want to call them memoirs because that sounds just pompous somehow. I don't know how. Memoirs. I don't want to call them memoirs. Memoirs is something you write when you think that you're important enough to write a memoir, whatever that's supposed to mean. Let's call them non-fictional writings. How about that? Anyway, here is one of the latest pieces from my non-fictional writings from a chapter called Growing Up. I've always found it ironic how dual in nature people are in regards to maturity. Adults lament no longer having the innocent whimsy of a child and then point to the nearest kid and tell him to grow up. Human beings are immaculately confused. They often talk about what it is to be grown up, but sometimes I wonder if they even know what such a thing is. Recently, I was digging around in an old box of mementos. You know the box I'm talking about, probably sitting in the back of your closet right now. Nothing actually functional inside, just certain random objects that you keep just for the stories behind them. An empty whiskey bottle, an old belt, an empty envelope. As much as I detest the grueling process of moving to another state, It does afford some interesting trips down memory lane. Brian looked at me sideways as I pulled some of the objects out of the box. Having been deployed twice in Iraq and once in Afghanistan, he'd learned to appreciate the value of a good story. He asked me about some of the items, to which I'd reply with a quick synopsis, but it was what I found at the very bottom of the box that interested him the most. An old brass bullet shell. "Hey, I didn't know you went shooting," he said. I rolled the casing around in my palm. "I didn't shoot this one." "Where'd you get it?" "My father gave it to me." He chuckled his gruff, perhaps not too worldly wise chuckle at me. "Hell, you're just not grown up until people are shooting them at you." I held the shell between my fingers. Brian paused and waited for me to tell him the rest of the story, but it was a story I didn't feel like telling him, and I still haven't. I put the shell back in the box, and I didn't say another word about it. 1981, Afton, Oklahoma. Population 934. 3 weeks before Christmas. 2:30 in the morning. I woke up with my father's 357 Magnum pressed against my head. I was 10 years old. The only way I knew how to describe it at that age was to say my father went crazy sometimes. I didn't know anything about recurring psychosis or paranoid schizophrenia or other terms with more letters in them than years I'd been alive. My father went crazy sometimes. That's all I knew. Sometimes for 3 or 4 months, sometimes for more than a year. There were usually periods of relatively normal life in between, but my brother, sister, mother, and me, we all knew that eventually, sooner or later, he'd go crazy again. We'd lived like a normal family for a year, maybe two, and then that certain tone would begin to return to his voice, where he'd almost be singing his words. Like there was something behind him he wanted you to decode. He'd say things like, "You can have all the ice cream you want. You know what I'm saying, don't you?" And then that blazing, piercing glare would return to his ice blue eyes like it was stabbing a hole into you, made all the more disturbing by the fact that no one had even mentioned ice cream. "Yeah, Dad, I know what you're saying." You didn't dare tell him. He was making no sense at all. We all knew when it was happening again. The knots in our stomachs would begin to get tighter every day. It would always begin almost harmlessly. Maybe you'd catch him staring at the mayonnaise jar for minutes on end, or find pages of random handwritten letters on the coffee table. You might come home to find the curtains drawn and all the lamps unplugged. All things we might have just dismissed, but we knew it was just going to get worse, much worse. He'd begin to talk about old friends and acquaintances as though they were after him. He'd interrogate us regularly about who we'd seen and talked to that day. Sometimes he'd ask if we'd been contacted by any strange men in nice suits or people with strange accent or men identifying themselves as the FBI. Eventually, he'd barricade himself in a room with magazines and newspapers trying to decipher the hidden codes that the government was trying to send him. Sometimes for months. Sometimes until the smell coming from under the door was like a wild animal's cage. He'd stockpile weapons and sometimes build IEDs out of plumbing pipe or old toolboxes so he'd be ready for whomever it was that was inevitably coming to get him. That's when it started to get really bad. Usually, when my father started going crazy, we could always stay away from the house. My brother and I would often spend from morning until the sun went down playing in the park or visiting friends at their houses just to avoid going home. Sometimes I'd spend weeks on end voluntarily staying after school for hours, doing my homework in empty classrooms until they'd finally tell me I had to leave. Any excuse not to come home for just a little while longer, I'd take. But eventually, because he could never be sure where we were going or who we were talking to, my father would begin allowing only one family member to leave the house at a time, and we were only allowed to be gone for 30 minutes at most. Everyone else had to remain behind. Any thought I ever had of running away or going for help was quietly tucked away under the constant knowledge that the rest of my family was back in that cold, dark house with a crazy man who might do anything if I disobeyed. Besides, in a town of 900 people in the middle of endless spans of cow pastures and gravel pits, where would you get help anyway? Afton was so eventless, the tiny police station even closed at night. When we were home, we tried not to talk too much, especially not to my father. To say a thing like, "It's raining outside and the dog is still out," could, at any moment, be the signal phrase he was waiting for that instructed him to set the house ablaze or go on a shooting spree or, God forbid, pack us all in a car and drive us off a cliff somewhere. We didn't even talk to each other much. Sometimes he thought we were communicating in code. All of our conversations took place in short, whispering bursts, and only when we were sure he wasn't listening. Music and television contained secret messages, so we couldn't have those either. The house would be deafeningly quiet for weeks on end. At night, the lights had to remain off. It was easier for snipers to see in the windows if the lamps were on. Thus is how I came, on more than one occasion, to sitting in a cold, darkened living room, in the middle of the night, bathed in window pane squares of faint, shadowy blue light from the street lamp outside, in maddening silence except for the sound of my father, pacing heavily back and forth down the hallway just outside the room, cursing and raving at no one, and my mother, speaking in gasped, terrified whispers through a strange smile as she crouched in front of my siblings and I, and tried to tell us everything would be okay as we huddled together on a couch in the dark. It was horrifying, and no one knew it but us. "We haven't seen your old man around Morgan's lately." "Sorry, my father goes crazy sometimes." It felt like a dirty family secret. And as I laid on my bed with my father's gun pressed against my head, I wondered if I would become part of that secret. If perhaps my family would shuffle their feet nervously and explain how I'd gone to live with a distant relative after I'd been buried quietly in the backyard one night. The last time my father went crazy, he thought the police were after him. He thought they wanted to put him in a little room and flood it with deadly gas because of some secret information he'd learned when he was a police officer in 1966. This time, he thought the ones after him were us, his own family, or at least that we were part of the conspiracy. For the past couple of months, he'd been secretly planting bugs throughout the house so he could listen in on our conversations. Now we couldn't even whisper to each other anymore. We started communicating by scrawling quick notes on bits of napkin in our old grocery bags and slipping them to each other as we passed in the hallways, hoping to God our father never found them. The last note I'd slipped was to my brother, telling him when I'd be up to watch Saturday morning cartoons and asking if he'd join me. Unfortunately, earlier that evening, my father found the note laying on the floor. It said, "Tomorrow, 5 a.m., no one will be awake." I held my breath and looked blankly at the ceiling, waiting for what would come next. My father leaned close, pressing the gun harder against my head. "Who are you working for, boy?" His breath smelled like stale cigarettes. "I'm not working for anyone, Dad." My voice cracked. It was the first time I'd used it in several days. "Don't lie to me! I know your mother is getting instructions from someone, I know she's sending message with the transmitter in the garage, and I know you're helping her. Tell me who it is." I wanted to make something up. He'd never believe there was actually no conspiracy, no spies, no secret communications. And the thought of denying it all again made me feel like throwing up, knowing how angry he'd be. As horrible a person as I knew it made me, I wanted to give him a name, any name, as long as he'd go after that person and forget about me. But at the moment, I could barely remember what day it was, much less summon the creativity to weave a tale he'd believe. Despite popular belief, it's very hard to lie when there's a gun at your head. I swallowed heavily and spat the words. "No one. I swear, no one is working for anyone." I felt my father's hand tremble for a moment over my throat, and then I found myself literally being jerked from the bed and hurled onto the floor. The carpet was cold and coarse, and something had cut across my side when I'd landed, probably one of my toys I'd left out. "Get up!" I stood slowly, pretending to be more hurt than I was. My father was a boogeyman silhouette backlit by my bedroom window like a shadow that pulled itself off the wall and was walking around in real life. He raised the gun. I saw a metallic glint.
"Who's coming at 5 o'clock?
I heard the hammer click back heavily.
"No one. No one's coming." "Tell me, boy, I'm gonna shoot you."
As many times as we'd tried to explain to my father that his delusions weren't real, he'd never believed us. In fact, it only angered him. His mind had created a world for itself, and in that world, no matter what you did or said, it always, always fit into the inevitable, inescapable plot that had been authorized by his madness. And no matter how many times we found ourselves tumbling helplessly into our prescribed roles within his cast of dangerous spies, shady characters, and co-conspirators, no matter how many times we watched our pleas for reason chiseled as suspicious dialogue, mocking insults, or admissions of guilt in the script of the terrible play he was living, there was always the impossible hope that this time there'd be a revelation. This time you'd say just the right thing that would turn the lights on in his eyes. That this time you'd break through the insanity and this nightmare would end. I didn't care anymore. The months of continual fear had scarred itself over for me. I would either get through to him or he'd shoot me. And at that moment, I had a preference for neither. I clenched my jaw. "No one is working for anyone, Dad. No one is coming to get you. No one ever has been. You've made this all up in your head and you're scaring everyone. None of it's real. Why can't you understand that?" The shadow shuffled for a moment, almost stumbling back a step, maybe in some kind of disbelief. He lifted his hand to his forehead and thought. Then he cleared his throat, and he thrust the gun forward. Bang! For years, I wanted to believe that he purposely aimed away from me, that he wouldn't have really killed me. But that particular night, he thought I was an imposter, planted there by U.S. military intelligence. The fact was, in the darkened room with shaking hands, he'd simply missed. The bullet passed an inch or so away from my right ear. He'd intended a headshot. I learned this from him a year before he died, during a time when he was clear-headed. Once he'd missed, he just didn't have the heart to try again. The gun dropped from his hand, and he walked out of the room without saying a word. Later that morning, I found the revolver on the floor and opened the cylinder. A single, empty bullet casing fell out. The next day, my father claimed that he never shot at me. He explained that he drilled a hole in the wall earlier that day and fired a blank in the kind of prankish way one puts a bucket of confetti over a door. And at the time, that's something he might have done. But the day after, he admitted firing a real bullet at me. When I doubted him, he handed me his pocket knife. "Go dig a bullet out of that wall and I'll give you a nice shiny dollar," he said. I followed the bullet path through my closet, out the other side, and into the bathroom where I found a broken piece of tile on the opposite wall. I scraped away some of the plaster and found a flattened .357 Magnum slug. It took a little digging, but I managed to wrench the bullet out of the wall and brought it to my father. The son of a bitch gave me a dollar. I don't know whatever happened to the bullet. I still have the empty shell. Brian finally asked me, "Well, what happened? Why did you keep it?" I just told him it was something I like to keep around. Later, what Brian said got me thinking. "You're not grown up until people are shooting them at you," he said. "I'm not sure I know what being grown up is, but I know what it isn't. Some people grow up slowly and some have to do it fast. But it doesn't matter if you're a child or a grown-up as long as you're moving toward one or the other. The point to life isn't being a grown-up, but to be growing up. The point is to be changing. Whether you're a child or an adult, as long as you're shifting toward new perspective, then you're moving. And if you're not, then you're just sitting still. A stationary blip frozen to the processes that offer learning, experience, and life. Some people seem proud to have grown up quickly or early in life. But to me, if a moment in your life has enough impact to instantly transform you from a child to an adult, I'm not so sure that's something to be proud of. I think it's probably important to mention at this point that not all of the readings I do will be as depressing, I'm going to say, as this one might have been. Some of them will, but I'll throw in some lightly humorous and thoughtful stories from my past here and there as well. Either way, I will try to make sure that every one of them has something to think about or learn from. I might even throw in a few recipes here and there or some tips on building shelves, how to get a stain out of you know, a shirt. I don't know. Whatever it is, I hope it will be useful and thought-provoking. Basically, what you could say this show is, this is like To the Ranting Griffin, except add the whole person in. And for this first radio-free potato, I'm going to wrap it up until next time. The show isn't on any particular schedule, so they'll just come out when I actually have the time to make them. I'm hoping for maybe one a month or so. That's a basic estimate. Music used on the show was Tectonic Shift by Todd Gautru, Inscene by Isaac Jaffe, Dark Angel by Emil Milan Carroll, Far by Robin L. Klein, Forest for the Trees by Dee DeFonso, Alpine Resort by Robert Mann, Transmission by Mark Stevens Cook, and Down by Stephen Beckett. All of the music on Radio Free Potato is used under the royalty-free license. Radio Free Potato is copyright Ranting Griffin Studios, and if you want to write about the show, or anything else for that matter, email to at ranting-griffin.com or go by my website at www.ranting-griffin.com. Thank you all for tuning into the show this week, and I bid you all a fond farewell until next time.